Today's broadcast originally aired on November 2nd, 2023.
There are some mysteries so great, they have puzzled us for centuries. It's time to investigate history's greatest mysteries.
Yes, it is. Well, at least the week's greatest mysteries.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, up in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Well, as you heard the man say, Desi Doyen, at the top of the show, we've got a lot of mysteries to deal with today.
Yes, we do.
Mysteries in today's news, and if not history's greatest mysteries, well, as I said then, you know, perhaps... oh, I don't know, the last 24 to 48 hours, greatest mysteries. so that's where we're going to start today. And let me start this story by noting up front very clearly, so there is no confusion about it. I don't want anyone to get worried out there. I am not dead. Seriously, I swear. This is
no
not
fooling.
This is not an AI version of me. Of course, that's exactly what I would say if this were an AI version of me and I was trying to fool you. So you'll have to make the final call there. But really, no matter what you have read on the internet, I am not dead. That said, if you thought otherwise, I might not blame you, because there was that caught my attention last night, as you'll see why in a second, as a link to this webpage came into my email via the Google alert that I have set up for my name, so that when people say lovely or not so lovely things about me out on the internet, that's right. I'll get an alert about it. I'll see this alert, like the one that I received last night, that was linking to a web page that really did catch my attention in particular. Now, I'm not going to give the name of the website because I don't want you to go there, nor do I want to give them any traffic in any way. But here's what it says. And believe me, I was at least as surprised to see it as you may be to hear it. November 1, 2023, Brad Friedman, obituary. Bradley Lewis Friedman, known for his multifaceted career as a blogger, journalist, actor, radio broadcaster, director, and software programmer, left an indelible mark on the world of media and politics. He was a prominent figure in New York City, and his sudden passing is a great loss. One of Brad Friedman's significant contributions was through his blog, where he covered critical issues surrounding voting rights and election integrity in the United States. His blog served as a platform to discuss a wide range of topics related to media reform and political corruption, all viewed from a progressive standpoint. Brad's dedication to highlighting these issues was evident in his passionate and unwavering pursuit of justice. Among the focal points of his blog was a critical examination of Premier Election Systems, formerly known as Diebold Election Systems, ESNS, Sequoia Voting Systems, and electronic voting systems in general. His work shed light on the challenges and vulnerabilities in the American electoral system, advocating for transparency and accountability. This is so sad.
He sounds like a nice guy.
I will be missed. Brad Friedman's contributions extended beyond his blog. His diverse talents allowed him to engage with a wide audience. He leveraged his skills to advocate for the causes he held dear. In the world of media and journalism, Brad Friedman's voice was distinct. Don't laugh at that part. Don't laugh at any of this. This is not funny. This is very sad. He addressed issues that were often contentious and divisive. His commitment to progress and integrity in the electoral process earned him respect. Respect, Desi Doyen. And admiration from those who shared his passion for democracy and transparency. His sudden passing leaves a void in the world of blogging, journalism, and progressive activism. However, Brad's legacy remains in the countless articles, broadcasts, and contributions he made throughout his career. His work will continue to inspire and inform those who champion the causes he held dear, and his dedication to truth and accountability will be remembered for years to come.
That's a very nice one.
Weird, though, huh?
Very.
Of course, one of the first... That's an actual web page. And again, just to repeat the top story here, I am not dead. But you can understand why this old chestnut from Monty Python was sort of going through my head all night long.
Bring out your dead one.
I'm not dead.
What? Nothing. Here's your nine puts.
I'm not dead.
Yeah. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
I can't take him.
I feel fine.
You're not fooling anyone, you know.
I feel happy.
Oh, thanks very much.
Not at all. See you on Thursday.
Right.
So, yeah, that was sort of going through my head all night long.
I'm not dead yet.
Now, one of the first things that came to my mind is I was processing this page, and it really was kind of bizarre seeing, you know, my own obit Few people are actually lucky enough to be able to read their own obituary, I guess. And
I would wager, yes.
Learn what people think about them. So I thought, oh, well, that's nice. Then the second thing I thought was that I guess someone needs to, you know, do a few updates perhaps to my Wikipedia page where most of this stuff seems to have been scraped from. And then I wondered... I actually wondered this the whole time. WTF?
Yeah, who would do such a thing and why?
I have no idea. Now, I tried to figure it out, though. The headline on the page is actually Brad Friedman, obituary, New York City partner at Wilkie Farr and Gallagher LLP has died. Now, I don't live in New York City anymore, and I'm not a partner at any law firm in no small part because I'm not a lawyer. So I looked up that headline and I found another obituary site that also had the very same headline, which seemed to be the correct one until I actually read it and noticed that it was actually a marriage notice for someone named Bradley Scott Friedman.
Different middle name.
So, and another misfire because it talked about a completely different person than the one named in the headline. Now, apparently there is a Bradley Miles Friedman, who is an attorney and who worked at Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, though in 2023, according to a New York State records, he moved to Kirkland and Ellis LLP. And I have no idea, frankly, if he is dead or not. I certainly hope he is not. The world needs all the Bradley Friedmans it can find, I guess. So, but I think what is going on here is that it's some kind of AI misfire where, you know, maybe something happened to that New York attorney, Brad Friedman, though I hope not, which then triggered these sleazy obit sites to scour the net for Brad Friedman. And then they found articles about me and the AI created this page, actually two, one about me, one about Bradley Scott Friedman, apparently, in his very lovely marriage ceremony that I enjoyed reading about. Both of the sites, by the way, that showed up in the Google alert when I went to check them out, triggered my Norton security as a malicious site, which tried to attack me when I opened them in my browser, attack my computer system. Norton alerted me that it had blocked the attempted malicious attack. So I'm not going to give you any of the website names, and I urge you to not look up Brad Friedman and death or something.
Yeah, don't go to that site. Don't look them up. Don't give them any traffic.
But I wanted to let you know that I'm just fine. And by the way, I don't know if I've fallen into their trap, whatever it may be, by reading my own pretty nice, if not completely accurate, and almost certainly AI-written obit. I don't know if I've fallen into the trap by reading it to you, but I did want to let anyone know who might have seen it that I am not, in fact, dead. Desi, can you confirm that? Okay, thank you.
But it is good to be aware that there are these kinds of things floating around, and they're going to probably get even more so as AI infiltrates more areas of the internet. So just be cautious.
Correct. Yes. If a relative calls you asking for money, saying they're in trouble, make sure it's really them and not an AI them.
An AI-generated voice, because you can ask them questions that an AI-generated voice or person on the other end wouldn't understand or know the answers to.
So why was all of this done? Frankly, I have no idea. But it was probably some attempt to get traffic, I guess, to a site that would then take over my computer or your computer. So, you know, if you learn in a Google search that you have died, and it only if you are certain that you have not, well, you would probably be wise to not visit that page, or at least make sure that your virus protection on your machine is up to date. So
yeah, practice good internet hygiene.
Unclear what happened here. So for now, it is
one of history's greatest mysteries.
Chilling. It is one of the greatest mysteries. It's one of a number of them that actually caught my eye overnight and today. Here's another. Now, this one was brought to my attention last night by Doc, a listener over on Facebook, where you should follow us, by the way, at The Brad Blog. This one comes from the reputable Reuters news service. Headline, U.S. halts exports of most civilian firearms for 90 days. The U.S. has stopped issuing export licenses for most civilian firearms and ammunition for 90 days for all non-governmental users, the Commerce Department said on Friday, citing national security and foreign policy interests. The Commerce Department did not provide further details for the pause, which also includes shotguns and optical sights, but said in an urgent review, it said an urgent review will assess the, quote, risk of firearms being diverted to entities or activities that promote regional instability, violate human rights, or fuel criminal activities. In other words, sales by the firearms industry to overseas terrorists will be stopped. The Commerce Department for 90 days. The Commerce Department declined to comment beyond the posting on its website. According to the Reuters report, the halt covers most of the guns and ammo that would be purchased in a U.S. gun store, according to a lawyer who specializes in export controls and firearms in Washington. Joanna Reeves said she had not seen the Commerce Department take such a sweeping action like this before. Quote, for sure they have individual country policies, but nothing like this, she said. Export licenses for Ukraine and Israel, however, as well as some other close allies, will be exempted from the temporary halt in exports. Exporters can continue to submit license requests during the pause, but they will be, quote, held without action until the pause is lifted. That, according to the announcement from the Commerce Department. For shipments to government clients, exporters must name specific end users. While applications with unnamed government, military, and police users will be, quote, returned without action. So what is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually know, and the listener who brought it to my attention didn't either, had some ideas, but I tried to look into it a little bit, but it does appear to be
one of history's greatest mysteries.
At least for now, because I did look into it, and without knowing what this was about, I gotta say, frankly, it sounds good to me. Less guns generally equates with less death. Now, there is actually shockingly little coverage out there of this story, though. And even though the Reuters story was from last Friday, by the way, so almost a week ago, and yet I haven't heard Republicans yelping and hopping mad about it since then. Maybe they have bigger problems these days, but there was this from who else? A pretty brief stub from the NRA, of course. That seems to have offered a clue. They write, on Friday, the Biden administration announced there would be a 90-day, quote, pause on commercial firearm exports. The pause comes amid other administrative actions and a commitment by this administration to, according to the NRA, exhaust every option to make firearm commerce more difficult. Okay, but why should the NRA care? I thought they were all about gun safety, and protecting the Second Amendment. That's what they like to pretend. The Second Amendment, however, does not apply to other countries. So why should the NRA be so upset about it? Why are you so mad, NRA? Oh, right. Because it was actually never about either gun safety or the Second Amendment for you, was it, NRA? It was about supporting the gun industry. Firearms manufacturers, no matter if it means tens of thousands of Americans will be killed by their weapons each year or that the guns end up in the hands of terrorists around the world. Which is why I have long called the NRA the terrorist-supporting NRA, and I stand by it. The terrorist-supporting NRA continues their complaint. In 2020, export control for most commercial arms, ammunition, and accessories was moved from the State Department to the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Industry and Security, or BIS. The pause, they write, is by far the most drastic move. It's drastic. Drastic move the BIS has taken to restrict firearm exports since it took over jurisdiction. One might expect such a major change in policy to be front and center on the government's agency website, the NRA notes, but notice of the pause was hidden at the bottom of the BIS frequently asked questions page. They whined. The notice on the FAQ page also gives little reason for why the pause is necessary, they say, beyond noting that the pause, quote, will enable the department to more effectively assess and mitigate risk of firearms being diverted to entities or activities that promote regional instability, violate human rights, or fuel criminal activities, which sounds like a good thing to me, but apparently not to the NRA, who was very critical. We don't want to do anything that, you know, might prevent criminal activity. That statement, they write, and the timing seem to indicate that the, quote, pause is in response to recent reporting by Bloomberg. Aha, a clue. Targeting the Commerce Department for, quote, exporting American, quote, gun culture at, quote, unprecedented levels. That was the Bloomberg story. Bloomberg even appears to be taking credit for the freeze, as they call it, notes the NRA. As with other export restrictions on the American firearm industry, all this move will do, NRA charges, is ensure that foreign demand for firearms, ammunition, and covered accessories is met by foreign suppliers who do not share America's interest in regional stability, human rights, or reducing criminal activities. And as you know, nobody cares about regional stability, human rights, and reducing criminal activities more than the NRA. Am I right? In any event, thank you, NRA, for pointing us to the Bloomberg coverage of this. the one that they're blaming for this happening, because that story, which is an epic 5,400-word investigative report published by Bloomberg in July, actually does offer some likely answers here. It's a really good piece and a long piece, but it begins this way. Last October, so that would be October of 2022, a recently fired police officer walked into his stepson's nursery school in the remote northeast of Thailand, and in under 30 minutes killed 23 children and two teachers. The rampage, which left a total of 36 dead, ranks as the worst in Thai history and one of the worst in the world. The killer's gun, a Sig Sauer P365, touted by the company as small enough to easily conceal, yet able to hold 13 rounds, had traveled more than 8,000 miles from a factory on New Hampshire's rocky seacoast to Thailand's lush Nong Bua Lamphu province. It was part of a growing number of semi-automatic handguns and rifles exported by American gun makers and linked to violent crimes. With about 400 million civilian firearms owned in the U.S., companies like SIG are seeking new buyers abroad, and they found an eager ally. The federal government has helped push international sales of rapid-fire guns to record levels. Great. The economic and political forces driving those sales were set in motion after the U.S. assault weapons ban expired in 2004 and Republicans refused to renew it. But they've reached new heights since gun makers in 2020 won a decade-long battle to streamline export approvals and moving oversight of exports, apparently, from the State Department to the more business-friendly Department of Commerce. Aha! The Department of Commerce, with, as Bloomberg describes, its decade-long support for the shooting, hunting, and outdoor trade show known as SHOT Show, a gun marketing expo that occurs every January in Las Vegas. Semi-automatic American-made guns are now pouring into countries ranging from Canada, with its comparatively strict regulations, to Guatemala, where firearms are frequently diverted into the hands of criminals and the government has trampled human rights. The U.S. Commerce Department has played booster and concierge, however, to the firearm industry, even as America's mass shootings horrify the world and gun crime rates rise in many of the importing countries. So it's not just guns that we are exporting, it is death. Commerce employees help recruit foreign buyers. This is our government doing this. They help recruit foreign buyers. They accompany them at the industry's premier exhibition in Vegas each year, and they offer an online portal to pair them with U.S. Gun manufacturers. How thoughtful. Giving them everything they need. Since the ban ended, semi-automatic exports have totaled 3.7 million, more than doubling in just the past 6 years. In absolute numbers, exports are still a fraction of domestic sales, but their impact on the nations receiving them can be enormous. Quote, "We as a country have been focused on stopping the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction," said Tom Malinowski, the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, from 2014 to 2017, and a former Democratic congressman. He said, but if you look at how civilians die in armed conflicts around the world, it's hard not to conclude that the true weapons of mass destruction are these small arms that are subject to the fewest controls. So that likely explains the pause that is being put in place. Finally.
So basically, it sounds like the Trump administration opened up the floodgates for exports, helping profit manufacturers of guns, and then the Biden administration has closed that door, at least temporarily.
For 90 days, which, to review what's going on, I would say that's a good thing, even if the terrorists supporting NRA is seemingly furious about it. as Bloomberg noted in their follow-up covering the freeze that was quietly announced on Friday. I mean, a week ago, and it's the first I've heard of it. Bloomberg said critics of the 2020 rule change praised the Commerce Department's decision to pause and review the policy that has flooded criminals and authoritarian regimes with these weapons. Quote, for too long, firearms from the U.S. have contributed to violence and instability abroad, said Congressman Joaquin Castro, who with Senator Elizabeth Warren have sought answers for the for more than a year from the Biden administration about the increase in approvals of assault weapons export licenses. This 90-day pause and review on small arms exports is a welcome announcement by the Commerce Department, added Castro. He said, I look forward to engaging with the department during this review so U.S. policy moves in the right direction. At least on this one small part of our gun epidemic, at least maybe we can somewhat put the brakes on exporting them around the world to criminals and terrorists and authoritarian nations, at least, even if we still export them to other nations. What happens after this 90-day review? And by the way, why has this pause, which is actually pretty big news, it seems to me, why has it received so little coverage from the corporate media since it was issued almost a week ago on Friday? I don't know. That's another.
One of history's greatest mysteries.
And here's one more. And it's a really interesting one. Now, I think we've all been reading up on newly anointed GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson, since nobody, including even the Republicans who elected him a week or so ago, actually knew much, if anything, about this guy before they allowed him to ascend to become Speaker of the House. And yes, the second in line to the presidency of the United States, right after Vice President Kamala Harris. So there's a lot of stuff that Democrats will be able to, you know, use against this guy and his party next year. Because he's just exceedingly radically religious, a far right winger. He has he also has an unexplained, supposedly adopted black son, as he describes him, who doesn't show up in any of his family photos, however, of Johnson and his wife and his four darling white children. And there are questions about that supposed son who Johnson claims to have adopted when the boy was 14 years old and Johnson was 25 years old.
As one does.
And unmarried at the time. Anyway, so yeah, that remains
one of history's greatest mysteries.
That's right. But here's another, and it's another scoop from the Daily Beast's excellent Roger Sullenberger today. Newly elected Speaker of the House Mike Johnson does not have a bank account. Huh? At least that's what Johnson reports on years of personal financial disclosures, which date back to 2016 and reveal a financial life that, in the context of his role as a congressman and now speaker, appears extraordinarily precarious. Over the course of 7 years, Johnson has never reported a checking or savings account in his name, nor in the name of his wife or any of his children, disclosures show. In fact, he doesn't appear to have money stashed in any investments, with his latest filing covering 2022 showing no assets whatsoever. Huh? Now, of course, the first thought that came to my mind was, well, okay, good. He's not beholden to some industry or another where he's got a bunch of personal investments. You know, he's got millions of dollars invested in big pharma or whatever. No, he's got nothing. But this is just weird. And to not have a bank account, if that is true, it raises other concerns, as Sullenberger posits. He writes, of course, it's unlikely that Johnson doesn't actually have a bank account.
Yeah, his paychecks aren't going to just melt into thin air.
Well, He continues. What's more likely, he suggests, is Johnson lives paycheck to paycheck, so much so that he doesn't have enough money in his bank account to trigger the checking account disclosure rules for members of Congress. The House Ethics Committee filing guidelines state that the members must disclose bank accounts if they have that they have at every financial institution, as long as the account holds at least $1,000 and the combined value of all the accounts, including those belonging to their spouse and their dependent children, exceeds $5,000. It's certainly not uncommon, Sullenberger writes, for Americans to have less than $5,000 in their bank accounts. Most Americans, 57% of them, in fact, couldn't handle an unexpected $1,000 expense, according to a report earlier this year. And the median amount that Americans keep in their bank account is actually just $5,300. But Johnson's household income puts him in the top, his income puts him in the top 12% of earners in the U.S., and it's extraordinarily rare for members of Congress to not list a qualifying bank account, let alone zero assets whatsoever. The Daily Beast reached out to his office for comment, did not receive a reply. A communications director, Jordan Leibowitz, for the watchdog group Crew, offered a more blunt assessment, saying that if Johnson truly doesn't have any assets, it, quote, raises questions about his personal financial well-being. Right. Which means he could be susceptible to all kinds of things now that he is speaker and in a position that industries might want to have some influence on him, you know. As Leibowitz told the Daily Beast, quote, it's strange to see Speaker Johnson disclose no assets. He made over $200,000 last year, and his wife took home salary from two employers as well, so why isn't there a bank account or any form of savings listed? Johnson also carries debts over, carried debts over for several years, which Leibowitz said would sharpen that question. He owes hundreds of thousands of dollars between a mortgage, personal loan, home equity line of credit. So where did that money go? If he truly has no bank account and no assets, it raises questions about his personal financial well-being. That fact, he said, could be seen as a vulnerability to exploit. One of the reasons we have these financial disclosures, he says, is to know whether politicians are having financial difficulties, which could make them ripe for influence buying. All in all, Johnson and his wife appear to have steadily earned more than $200,000 a year. However, they do face some steep costs, among them raising four children. I guess they're not including the other guy.
Apparently not.
And a second place for Johnson to crash while he is in D.C. He also appears to have a relationship. He does have a relationship with bankers. In 2019, the Louisiana Bankers Association issued a press release showing Johnson meeting with executives from a number of banks, including Citizens National, which apparently owns all of Johnson's liabilities, his home mortgage, personal loan, home equity, line of credit, and so forth. Johnson also doesn't list any accounts with the Congressional Federal Credit Union, a frequently used institution among House members following the congressional check-bouncing scandal of the 90s. Remember that one? Even the notoriously opaque Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has disclosed that he has a CFCU account. While a low net worth is far from the worst disclosure about Johnson, it's revealing in several ways. For one, writes Sullenberger, his complete lack of assets show that for a conservative, he isn't as conservative with his own finances as he strives to be with the federal government's. For another, it could be indicative of his post-Congress plans, with Johnson appearing to not have even a single dollar in the stock market, or a savings account, or a retirement plan. The new speaker may have plans to use his congressional position as a springboard to something more lucrative once he's done in government. That could happen once he's done, but if the new speaker sees a boon while he's in office, he certainly wouldn't be the first member of Congress to do so. So who knows? Is that what is going on here, or does this in fact remain
one of history's greatest mysteries?
I have no idea. And, you know, I was, all of these stories, I'm like reading them, and it's like, well, they're really interesting, but they seem to have no real answers.
No resolution just yet.
So let's take a quick break here. I think that mostly does it for the history's mysteries portion of our program today. But there was actually one more mystery that I was looking into regarding the failed expulsion, the vote in Congress on Wednesday for one of history's greatest liars and apparent criminals, New York Congressman George Santos. But I think I did found an answer that is fairly good to that mystery. We will discuss that and the delightful Nikki Haley. And we've even got a Green News report for you today. Am
yes,
I correct about
do.
That?
With, absolutely.
I think some very good news from the Biden administration for farmers and ranchers in rural America. All of that when we come back after a quick break. If we come back on the broadcast, a question which still remains
one of history's greatest mysteries.
Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
I'm back.
I am.
Back in the New York groove.
Mystery solved.
Back in the New York groove.
We are back. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Feeling great, just to make that clear. Not dead yet. Congressman George Santos, the embattled New York Republican who admitted to lying about his background, who has been indicted on 23 federal fraud charges, easily survived a bipartisan effort to expel him from the House of Representatives on Wednesday, according to NBC. Santos was indicted in May on 7 counts of wire fraud, 3 counts of money laundering, 1 count of theft of public funds, and 2 counts of making materially false statements to Congress on campaign forms. He was hit with 10 additional counts just last month, including conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States, wire fraud, making materially false statements to the Federal Election Commission, falsifying records submitted to obstruct the FEC, aggravated identity theft, and even device fraud. Serious charges all. He has pleaded not guilty to all of them, claiming it's part of a politically motivated, quote, witch hunt against him. Wednesday's expulsion resolution that failed was led by his fellow New York Republicans, however, and they say that Santos is, quote, not fit to serve. To be successful, the measure needed support, however, from a supermajority in the U.S. House, or at least 2/3 of the voting lawmakers, in order to pass. By the way, he is also currently being investigated by the House Ethics Committee for a whole bunch of stuff related to all of these lies and the federal charges, stealing donors' credit cards, etc., lying to the FEC about it. The final tally, however, on his expulsion vote on Wednesday night did not even meet a simple majority threshold, much less a super majority threshold. 179 voted in favor of expulsion of George Santos, but 213 voted against, and 19 voted present. Ethics groups like the excellent Public Citizen were outraged that Congress failed to expel George Santos. I got a statement from them via email last night saying the failure to expel Santos is a disservice to his constituents and all Americans. They note tonight the House voted not to expel Congressman George Santos from Congress despite concrete evidence from criminal indictments and in-depth reporting showing he lied extensively to his voters throughout the campaign. That was his 2022 campaign when he was first elected. Lisa Gilbert, the executive vice president of Public Citizen and the co-leader of the Not Above the Law Coalition, said, quote, George Santos should have been expelled. Politicians need to restore trust in our democracy, but the members who failed to act on one of the most thoroughly investigated and clear-cut cases of fraud by a House member are further eroding that trust. Santos's constituents deserve real representation, and Americans deserve to know that the people they elect to office are not above the law. And she is not wrong in general. I thought the very same thing when I saw the results come in that somehow he was not expelled. Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't make sense. And she's absolutely right. His constituents do deserve to have their best representation.
Yep. So what? But yes, what happened here? Well, as I said, this was one of those mysteries that I was digging into overnight, and I know why Republicans, in fact, there were 182 of them, I know why they voted against expulsion. For one reason, they have an incredibly thin margin in their majority, so they need every vote possible, whether it comes from a serial liar and almost certain to soon be convicted felon. They don't care. But also because their favored presidential candidate for next year has also been charged with 91 felony counts in four different indictments. And they'd hate to set a bad example if they vote for, you know, that Santos should be disqualified from office for pending felony charges. Well, they'd have a hard time justifying the support to their support to elect Donald Trump as president next year, wouldn't they? Now, 24 Republicans, to their credit, did vote with 155 Democrats to remove Santos. But here's the real mystery. Why did 31 Democrats vote against removing Santos from office? That was a bit of a mystery to me last night until I saw Congressman Jamie Raskin's explanation for why he voted against the expulsion of Santos, and it actually made a lot of sense and, frankly, immediately made me, at least, change my mind about expelling Santos at this time. As Raskin, who is a constitutional law expert, explained, quote, I'm a Constitution guy. The House has expelled five people in our history, three for joining the Confederacy as traitors to the Union, and two after they were convicted of criminal offenses. Santos has not been criminally convicted yet of the offenses cited in the resolution, nor has he been found guilty of ethics offenses in the House internal process. He says this would be a terrible precedent to set. Expelling people who have not been convicted of a crime and without internal due process. If and when Santos is convicted of these serious criminal offenses or ethics charges, I will certainly vote to expel. Until then, it's a very risky road to go down, and we have to stick by due process, he says, and the rule of law, as obvious as the eventual result seems. He notes, I can think of four or five Democratic members that the Republicans would like to expel without a conviction or adverse ethics findings. He says we can't abandon due process and the rule of law in the House of Representatives.
I agree with him on that.
I do, too.
After reading that, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense.
That does make sense.
I get it. Not at this time.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, you know, anytime anyone does anything wrong, well, let's have a vote to expel them, even without a House Ethics Committee investigation, a House Ethics Committee finding. There is an investigation underway, but they have made no finding yet.
It would be ripe for political mischief.
Now, one more before we get to the Green News Report here. This is, so there was a new polling out from Iowa this week, the gold standard for polling from the Des Moines Register, finding that Donald Trump is still way ahead of everyone else. According to the poll, 43% of likely Republican caucus goers pick Trump as their first choice for candidate, while 16% chose DeSantis and another 16% chose Nikki Haley of South Carolina. Then there's others. Tim Scott follows, Vivek Ramaswamy, et cetera. They're all in single digits. But here's what I noticed about that. Trump, yes, has 43% support, but if you add up all of the support for his challengers, that comes to about 51%. In other words, if all but one of them dropped out, he or she might be beating Trump in Iowa among the really the farthest right Republicans who participate in the caucus process there. Now, we don't know what would, you know, happen if those challenging Trump ended up leaving, if in fact they would go to Trump or they would go to, you know, other challengers. But, you know, when they say that Trump just seems so unbeatable, I don't know that he is. That said, the tied for second place Nikki Haley, after she's been getting a bump from that poll over the past week, she was on The Daily Show last night, and she was asked about term limits for members of Congress in the House and Senate, which is apparently something that, for reasons she explained, she is actually in favor of.
I think that we have to have term limits. And a lot, it's two reasons. One is, you know, I told you, I think the Senate's the most privileged nursing home in the country. They stay too long. They get used to the power. But the other side of it is, when you run for office, you're as close to the people as it gets. You've listened, you know what people want, and you really know how to go in there and get things done. The longer you stay, the more you move away from the people. And I think that's what's happened, is you look at what's happening in D.C., and they're so tone deaf, both Republicans and Democrats. And so, yeah, I think we need to have term limits, because I think we have a lot of people in D.C. who have literally lost what the American people want. And I think that we need to start having that again. Mm-hmm. We had term limits when I ran for governor. You've got term limits for anyone that runs for president. That way you go in there, you focus on the people, and you focus on your legacy. And I think that's important.
Okay. So the people are just, they're too long.
They're just too old.
They're too old. They're there too long. But you disagree, I think, with
idea of term limits. Yes. To me, term limits are for when you want to restrict who other people can vote for. Mm. I mean, if you like your representative, you don't get to keep your representative, because yes, somebody else in some other district somewhere decided that, you know, your person's been there too long. I want to get my guy in. So let's make this artificial limitation on them so that they can get in.
And we tend to hear from Republicans, you know, particularly in places where Democrats do well.
Right.
And then when they get in office, after calling for term limits, suddenly they decide, well, you know, work here is not done.
Yeah, they never do leave. And so most people don't actually look into what term limits could do in practice. One of the things that they do is that they elevate inexperienced lawmakers who then have to rely on lobbyists and party apparatchiks to tell them how to write laws and stuff.
Now, she has been apparently calling for a 3-term limit for members of Congress. So that would be 6 years and two terms for members of the Senate. So 12 years if you're in the Senate, after which I guess you have served too long to be of use to anyone. You're out of touch with people. You got to go. But here's my question for Nikki Haley that I'm hoping someone in the media will ask her. If we assume that she is right about all of her reasons that members of Congress should be term limited, we obviously don't agree that she is right, but let's assume that she is right. If she is right about that, fine. Okay. So, therefore, for all of the very same reasons, is she also calling for term limits for Supreme Court justices? Because I bet she is not. And I was really hoping that someone would ask her that on The Daily Show. But if members of Congress are, you know, so out of touch, too out of touch to be mm-hmm. making laws, well, surely, you know, folks like 75-year-old Clarence Thomas, who's been serving on the Supreme Court interpreting the law of the land for more than 30 years now, certainly he should also be termed out, should he not, Nikki? So, just wanted to get that out there.
Mm-hmm.
$5 to the first member of the media or a citizen, even at one of her town halls. She's out there, you know, campaigning around the country. $5 for the first person to ask her that at a town hall or anywhere else. Because as far as I can tell, nobody has actually asked her that yet. So now would be a very good time. Just saying. Green News Report is next, right here on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. I will melt for you, Desi Doyen. Are you ready to take us home? You ready to take us out today?
Sure.
Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
There was an Amber Alert in place overnight, but no one anticipated this deluge.
Storm Kieran, latest to rapidly intensify before slamming into the UK and France. Human activities are making the earth saltier, and not in a good way. Plus...
today, I'm proud to announce new funding will go directly to rural communities to fix aging critical rural infrastructure like electricity, water, wastewater systems that haven't been replaced in decades.
Biden launches major investments in America's farm country to boost resilience and fight climate change.
All of that major news and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The windmills are driving them crazy. They're driving the whales, I think, a little batty.
Sir, do you happen to live near a windmill? Just wondering. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen. Here we go again with another storm rapidly intensifying, this time on a whole other part of the world.
Yes, unfortunately, as we go to air, Storm Kieran is lashing the UK and northern France with hurricane-force winds after undergoing explosive rapid intensification driven by record-warm ocean waters in the North Atlantic. Kieran is the second big storm in a week to slam into the UK. Warm oceans are also intensifying its rainfall, triggering renewed flooding in areas with already saturated ground. Scientists link the ocean heat and unusually warm global temperatures to human-caused climate change.
And they had no idea what was coming because of rapid intensification.
And now the Earth is getting saltier because humanity is messing with the Earth's salt cycle.
What?
With potentially dangerous consequences. That's according to a first-of-its-kind study this week in the journal Nature. Salts like calcium, magnesium, and regular table salt that are used in agriculture, mining, industry, and road salt treatments all are increasing salt concentrations in places where they don't normally occur. It's contaminating aquifers, corroding lead water pipes, affecting soils, freshwater lakes and rivers, crop production, and even the air. The researchers warn that excess salt is, quote, an existential threat to freshwater supplies flies across the U.S.
Now we have to be worried about salt.
In better news, this week the Biden Interior Department approved the largest offshore wind project yet for the U.S., 27 miles off the coast of Virginia. It is the fifth massive wind farm cleared to begin construction in U.S. waters and will ultimately power nearly a million homes.
Well, have they asked the whales about that?
However, the approval comes amid economic turbulence that's causing wind developers to delay projects along the East Coast. This week, Danish wind power developer Ørsted canceled two offshore wind projects off the coast of New Jersey, citing supply chain bottlenecks and high interest rates that are raising costs. Mm. The cancellations are a victory for anti-wind energy groups backed by fossil fuel interests that quickly formed to oppose the offshore wind projects and falsely blamed whale deaths on those wind projects.
Man.
Their windmills are causing whales to die in numbers never seen before. They're washing up ashore. I saw it this weekend. Three of them came up. You wouldn't see it once a year. Now they're coming up on a weekly basis. The windmills are driving them crazy.
Federal and independent scientific data indicate that most whale deaths are caused by commercial shipping and fishing gear entanglement.
No, it's the windmills that are driving them batty. Everybody knows it.
In other actions, the administration also overcame decades of drilling industry resistance to begin regulating nearly 500,000 miles of what are known as natural gas gathering pipelines for the first time ever, requiring leak detection and safety measures near residential areas, which the industry is not happy about.
You mean we did not used to inspect them for leaks near houses?
Yep. Finally, President Biden traveled to Minnesota this week to unveil $5 billion in new investments directly in rural America. Funding from the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure law will go to replace aging rural water and electric infrastructure, expand high-speed internet, and help farmers fight climate change and diversify by harvesting renewable energy.
We're investing nearly $20 billion to help farmers and ranchers tackle climate crisis through climate-smart agriculture and cover crops, nutrient management, reducing greenhouse gas emissions while improving overall health of the soil and the water.
Did you hear that, farmers and ranchers? Did you hear who's actually helping you out? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Oh, brother, thank you very much.
Yep.
Desi Doyen, thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. No paywall. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to donate to our work to help us stay on your public airwaves via bradblog.com/donate. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and yes, site still known as Twitter, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.